Thank you. Good morning. 65 years of social justice. What have we learned? Man, is that a bad topic. I don't know if Don came up with this or if I knew we were having lunch. One of us came up, gee, that sounds really good. And later I'm, you know, trying to write, and where did we come up with that topic? Little humility. Social justice is a huge topic. We've got to be out of here before Tuesday. So I'm not going to try to tell you everything that there is to say about social justice. And my colleague here, the social justice person on the church staff, may see things differently than I do, in which case she's probably right. I'm going to focus on that aspect of social justice in the world that's commonly referred to as international development, the development process typically done in so-called developing countries. What have we done and learned since World War II, which is when this all really got started, through programs of social action and socioeconomic intervention? We need to make a distinction, I think, between social justice, social action, and international development. Social justice, for one thing, it's not new. We haven't just been doing it for 65 years. The term was coined in the 1840s by a Jesuit who was studying Thomas Aquinas, who was writing in 1293. So this is not a new concept. Social justice, for me, is a vision, a dream, a goal, a commitment, an opportunity, a purpose. I'm not aware of any society or institution anywhere on the planet that has achieved full and complete social justice as of today. It's an ideal toward which we ought to work and do work. It has to do with an egalitarian society based on human rights and respecting the dignity of each person. Sounds absolutely UU, doesn't it? Social action, for me, is any deliberate action that moves in the direction of social justice. It could be a big movement or just a little step, but that's social action. Typically, social action is based on values or beliefs, and it tends to run a gamut from caring to change-making. Acts of caring make the status quo less painful, and that's good. Acts of change-making seek to fundamentally transform the status quo into something better. This takes all forms. The classic example of a caring social action in the past century is Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa came to each person dying in the gutters of Calcutta, and within her religious understanding, that person was Jesus Christ. And she cared for that poor, poverty-stricken, outcast, dying Indian as though he or she was Christ himself. And that was her motivation. She did wonderful work. I worked with Mother Teresa in Calcutta. I volunteered at her orphanage in New Delhi. I actually have an adopted daughter from her orphanage in New Delhi. I met her when she came to the States some years later. Mother Teresa deserves all of the admiration that the world ever gave her. But she was not involved in change-making. She dealt with each person as she found them. It was an act of caring. Sometimes caring takes a bizarre form. A friend of mine is an Episcopal priest in Virginia, and every year people in his church bake cookies and take them to the prisoners in the local prison. Absolutely drives him crazy. He said they never question, why does America have a higher percentage of its population in prison than any other civilized country? Why is the percentage of prisoners far higher with black prisoners than in general society? Why is there such a concentration in prison of people with mental, physical, and emotional disabilities? What's wrong with our prisons? But each year at Christmas, they would bake cookies and take cookies to the prisoners and never ask any difficult questions. And I expect from the prisoner's point of view, they just as soon have the cookie as not have the cookie. From my point of view, it's not enough. On the other hand, it's a famous story of an old man walking down a beach and he sees a little boy pick up something and flip it in the water. Just pick up something out of the sand and flip it in the water. And the old man gets closer and realizes the boy's picking up starfish. They're stranded in the sand. If you get it back in the water, they'll live. And the old man says, a little boy, there's miles and miles of beach. There's tens of thousands of starfish. How can you possibly hope to make a difference? The little boy said, made a difference to that one. Made a difference to that one. That's what acts of caring are about. Made a difference to that one. And there's something to be said for, I can't fix all of society, but I can reach out and touch you with loving, caring grace. The opposite side of Mother Teresa is a guy you'd never heard of. Shortly after Israel formed a society, they realized that they needed to establish an agricultural pattern for their country that would make agriculture work and contribute to the economy. The most common agricultural pattern was large landowners owned large tracts of land, and farmers basically didn't have land and were laborers, not very different from serfs in the Middle Ages. This is the 1950s, and Israel said this is not good enough. We want a system, we want to reform what's there and have a system where the person who works the land owns the land. And then they would put in cooperatives and other things to support all of that. They asked a gentleman from the Philippines, Jeremias Montemayor, to come and help them design this. Did a brilliant design, Israel implemented it, and it's still working. At about that time, Taiwan said, we have the same problem. The land is owned by big landowners, the ordinary farmers are peasants, they're serfs. We want to take land away from those who have it, the rich and powerful, and give it to those who don't have it, the poor, but who are actually on the land, working the land, making it productive, because the current system, the land doesn't produce much. If each farmer works his own land, it produces a lot more. Now this is radical. They're taking power from the rich and powerful and giving it to the poor. Try doing that in America in 2010. Not easy to do. But Taiwan committed to that, and they also asked Jeremias Montemayor to come and assist them. Same thing, he just helped them design a system that worked within their culture, highly efficient. He went back to his home country, the Philippines, tried to do the same in the Philippines, and you know the saying, a prophet is not without honor, save in his own country. Never got off the ground. Shortly before he died, he quoted Simon Bolivar, and he said, I have been plowing the sand. I said, no, you've been planting seeds, but they're slow to grow in Philippine soil. That's the other side. That's change-making. That's commitment to transforming the status quo. Now, international development is one area of social action. In very simple terms, it's a focus on alleviating poverty. We normally associate it with poor countries, Africa, Asia, Latin America, though it also happens in Florida and should. In international development, there are thousands of definitions of what are the problems. There are tens of thousands of solutions, some of which work. This is an important part of social action. It's where I spent much of my professional career, and that's really what I'm going to talk about this morning. The biggest efforts in international development are by governments. That's where the big money is. They're either bilateral, from this government to that government. The floods hit Pakistan. Thank goodness one of the first governments to step up and say we'll be there was the United States government, bilateral assistance. The other kind is multilateral, where relatively richer countries will give money to an institution, such as the United Nations Food Program or the Asian Development Bank, and then that institution will have various projects in poorer countries. That's where the bulk of the money happens. It's not where the bulk of the ideas come from. Most of the real change comes through people's organizations. In America, we call them nonprofits because our distinction is between that which makes profit and that which doesn't. In Europe, they're called non-governmental because the distinction is between that which is the government and that which is not the government. And important to understand that cultural difference. In America, the nonprofits overseas are always called NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And that is where the bulk of the ideas and the learning happens. And I've been very fortunate that's where I've done my entire career. I've worked with government agencies, but I've never worked for them. And I'll just say now, some of you are familiar with Heifer International. It's a wonderful organization. If you have questions about what it really is and what it really does, I'll be happy to take those later. I'm not going to go into that right now because I'm going to guess that most of you have a sense of it. In international development, again, there's a continuum. There's basic relief, there's development, and there's what I call transformation, Relief is like acts of caring. It reduces human misery. It's disaster response. When the tsunami hit, and Christmas was 2006, the entire world responded. Americans gave over $1 billion, not through their government, but through people like us. We responded to that. That's pure relief. People are in agony. We reached out to provide relief. One of the uproars over Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. Now there's a lot of talk about this is the 5th year anniversary, and still not much has been done. Not only rebuilding, but just elementary relief for the people didn't happen and hasn't happened. I said we got our start after World War II. There were some actions, some activities, some programs of this nature before World War II, but not very many. After World War II, there was a big push for America to rebuild Europe, the Marshall Plan. It's one of the best economic plans in the world for them and for us. And there are many people today who advocate we need a Marshall Plan for the developing world that works for them and for us. It's never gotten off the ground. Have you ever heard of CARE? C-A-R-E? You know what it stands for? Originally, it was the Cooperative of Americans for Relief in Europe. That's where C-A-R-E came from. And it was organized as a co-op. A lot of my background is in co-ops. CARE doesn't use that acronym. I mean, they use the acronym without the explanation. But what we found working in Europe is that other countries had the same problems. And from Reconstruction in Europe, we began to work in Africa and Asia and Latin America. And one of the quickest things that they figured out is that quick fixes don't work. The problems have been developing for centuries, and it's going to take a while to make a change. They also figured out that rarely does relief, humanitarian though it is, make any positive change. When the people have just been hit by a flood, they need immediately food, shelter, clothing, whatever. But within a week or two, they need to start rebuilding their lives. That's a whole different ballgame. And the question then becomes, how do we go about that? I'm going to give you a trite expression you all have heard before. Give a man a fish and he eats for a day. Teach a man to fish and he eats for a lifetime. The basic concept of that is valid. Just giving somebody food may feed them, and that has its own validity if they've just had a crisis. But in the long run, you need to enable them to care for themselves. I say it's trite. So a friend of mine says, give a man a fish and he eats for a day. Teach a man to fish, his wife will never forgive you. The problem is, it assumes that people in developing countries don't know how to fish. Excuse me? They have been fishing for 5,000 years. And you come from a country that's barely 200 years old, and you're going to tell them how to fish? One of the things that is in short supply in international development on the part of us white American Europeans who go mucking about in other people's backyards is a very short supply of humility. And I hope I've learned some of that over the years. I needed to, I admit it. The other problem with that cliche is that in so many cases, they were fishing just fine until a factory was put in upriver and started discharging crud into the water, or somebody came in and started drilling for oil and fouled up the water, or the government decided they would sell the land underwater just as you sell land above water, and where villages around a huge lake had been fishing those waters for centuries, now it's all cut up into fish ponds by whatever rich person bought some acres of it, and all the fish are, and the villagers can't fish anymore. So the real issue with fishing is not that they're stupid, but the fish have been killed or the people have been cut off from the fish. And sometimes we're involved in that. The oil drilling, the factories that go in, they're not all American, but some of them are. And we need to own that. As we worked more and more in this field, we began to look for, if these quick fixes don't work, how do you identify what it is that we're trying to get to? And a very good expression came up, the root causes of poverty. To deal with poverty, you've got to get at its root causes. Whatever in a society creates poverty is what needs to be addressed. Not just the symptoms of poverty, but the thing that actually feeds it. And this really becomes the basis for all of our activity in international development. What is the root cause of what's happening? Excuse me. To clarify this, let's look at terrorism. George Bush Jr. decided to invade Iraq one day, and he said, this is a war on terrorism. Well, number one, you don't have wars on isms. They don't work that way. And number two, he didn't fight terrorism. He fought some terrorists who, incidentally, had nothing to do with 9/11, as we now know, but he didn't fight terrorism. Where do terrorists come from? What leads someone to say, I'm willing to be a suicide bomber? That's a very unusual choice for a human being to make. We now know that from all over the world, they came from places where they had no land, no jobs, in many cases, no homeland, no money, no hope, no opportunities. They were oppressed, humiliated, angry. They had nothing to lose. Can you imagine being in a situation where you have nothing to lose? Now, it's been pointed out that the leaders of Al-Qaeda are middle-class, educated, well-to-do. Yeah, the leaders of revolutions typically are. But the rank and file are not. The leaders are not suicide bombers. They're training the suicide bombers. The people who are willing to make that commitment to whatever haven't got anything else going for them. So if you want to fight terrorism, how can you address the fact of life in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Palestine, in parts of Indonesia and the Philippines, where the Muslims come from, where the terrorists come from, who have nothing to lose and are drawn to this answer, at least feels like they can do something? It is difficult to address root causes. Even at the root causes of poverty, we always talk in socioeconomic terms. There's social issues and economic issues. But once you talk root causes, now you're talking politics. And I don't mean Republicans and Democrats or even conservatives and liberals. Politics is about power. Who has it and how they use it, and who doesn't have it and what they need to do to get it. And one of the things we know about power is those who have it never give it up willingly. Those who don't have it have to find a way to take it. Now you're talking root causes of poverty, and now you're getting in a very awkward position for a foreigner to be in. It's their country. They need to find some of those answers themselves. And we can be encouraging, but we can't lead that kind of an effort. It's inappropriate for us to do so. So we have relief. We have development. And the third piece is transformation. And my take on that is, while you want transformation to happen, you really cannot have a program that delivers 17 pounds of transformation on Thursday. It just doesn't work that way. In my experience, you make a commitment to something that is credible, doable, supportable. People say, yeah, that's a good idea. But you do it in a way that creates opportunities for transformation to come about. And transformation is much, much bigger than whatever this task is. And I'll give you some examples after a bit. Transformation happens in rare moments. And to do that, you've got to be very patient, opportunistic, insightful. Jesus told his disciples, you must be wise as serpents and gentle as doves. And if you want to make transformation happen in the developing country, that's a good approach. There's just no quick fix. There are other aspects, quick digression, other aspects to international development I'm not going to address. An obvious one is advocacy, fighting to get laws changed. In many cases, it's the most important thing that needs to be done. I didn't do a lot of it. I'm not an expert in that field, and my time is limited, so I'm not going to get into that. The other one is called constituent education. That is educating the people who support you so they understand it better. Again and again, people in India would ask me, what are you doing in America so Americans will understand this situation? They wanted to be understood. When I was at Heifer, we had regional offices all around the country, and while they did fundraising, their primary assignment was constituent education. We had 2,000 volunteers across the country who went out and spoke in churches and schools and Kiwanis, Rotary, service clubs, wherever they could be heard. And the first purpose was to educate Americans about the reality of poverty and what we can do about it. And of course, part of that is what HEFR is doing about it. And of course, we welcome support for HEFR, but the commitment was constituent education. It was not primarily focused on fundraising. Some of you heard of CROP. Maybe you participated in a CROP walk. CROP is the fundraising arm and constituent education part of Church World Service, for whom I worked for a number of years. Most of my work has been with ecumenical agencies, where groups of church denominations would come together and together they would carry out programs, or with cooperatives. And I've done some other stuff beyond that, but that's basically the kind of organization I work for. Let me move on. It's morning, and it's raining. We've spent the night sleeping in a Baha'i kubo, a farmer's nipa hut. And here we are outside Hingo'og City in the province of Cagayan de Oro, an island of Mindanao in the southern Philippines. The people in this area migrated here for land, just as Americans moved out west across the country for land. They've migrated from the Visayas, the central Philippines, into Mindanao because land was available. And the wealthier people took the better land, and the poorer people took what land they could get. And on top of this mountain next to us is a little village called Kianlagan. And a group of people came here and they started a community and they started farming and they started a little cooperative, and I'm working with a Filipino co-op organization. And so we're going to go visit them. But it's raining, I have no raincoat. They borrow a poncho for me from the local police station. And after years in India, when I'm in the field, I'm wearing sandals. This is not fancy work. And so we set out climbing the mountain. The road is not passable for vehicles. It's wide enough, but it's not really paved, and it's very undulating, and it's pure clay. I mean, bright, orange, pure clay. Kids could play with it. And I'm slipping and sliding in the rain. And so finally I take off my sandals so I can dig my toes in and get a grip. And walking with a couple of people from the national office and a couple of local people, five, six of us set off walking up the mountain to Kianlagan, and we walk all morning. We get there about noon, and here's a very poor small village. But they've done everything right. They understood intercropping. You might think a farmer would grow, you know, coconut and coffee and this product and that one and acreages for each. But in intercropping, you think vertically. The coconuts happen up there, and then the coffee happens here, and something else happens here, and something else grows at ground level, and you can do all of that on the same piece of land. So they'd done that very, very well. And the climate was such they had the right crops going. They'd organized their co-op. They showed me the little warehouse where they had stuff stored. They showed me their books, squeaky clean, talked to the leadership. They had a little reception lunch for us, the very best they could afford, I'm sure, very simple. And I was so impressed. They were doing everything right. I would have loved to have taken co-op people from all across Asia to Kianlagan. See how they're doing it? This is what you should be doing in your village. It was so impressive. So we met in a meeting, we talked to the people and so forth, and afterwards we're going back down the mountain. And I said to my colleague, a woman from the national office, I said, I feel really badly, I don't have anything to give them. And she said, oh yes you did. I said, no, you don't understand. In my agency, some of the higher ups have some discretionary funds and they can commit some money here based on what they feel is important, but I'm just an ordinary guy. I don't have that capacity within our agency. And she said, but you gave them what they need. I said, no, you don't understand. I want to give them something to honor them, to invest in them, to help them build their future. And I have nothing to give. And she said, but you gave them what they need. And I finally shut up and listened. She said, look at it from their perspective. You, an encanto, in the Philippines, an enchanted person, is not like a gnome or a fairy. It's very tall and white. I didn't write the myth, but that's part of their culture. So by their definition, I'm an encanto. You came all the way from America to their island, climbed their mountain barefoot in the rain just to say to them, I believe in you. She said, there's nothing else you need to give them. Very wise woman. I believe in you. That was 1979. Another story from 1908. Incidentally, all of these stories are true. 1908, an area called Ballycloch, outside of Bushmills. Anybody here drink whiskey? You've heard of old Bushmills? It comes from a little village in County Antrim called Bushmills. It's the oldest legal distillery in the world. I can tell you stories about Bushmills, but I'm not going to. My grandfather emigrated to this country in the 1890s, and he finished high school here. What percentage of Americans finished high school in the year 1900? Anybody know? Less than 6% finished high school 110 years ago. But my grandfather was one of them. And he went on to college. And he went on to seminary at the old Xenia Seminary in Xenia, Ohio. This is the United Presbyterian Church up north. It's the very conservative wig. Obviously, I escaped. And he eventually got a parish in southern Illinois. And he found a lovely local girl and married my grandmother. And in 1908, he and his bride went back to Northern Ireland so she could meet the family. Now, he was, by their standards, very successful. He was a minister. And if you're Catholic Irish, there's nothing better than a son who's a priest. If you're Protestant Irish, there's nothing better than a son who's a Presbyterian preacher. And while he was there, he noticed that the family still did not have an outhouse. You have to understand that the Irish in those days, like much of the world today, didn't use outhouses. You use an open field or go behind a tree, a gravestone. Cemeteries were popular places for these activities. They didn't have an outhouse. But my grandfather was accomplished. He was a man who was educated. And he decided he would build them a proper outhouse. He went out, he bought the lumber, and with his own hands, he built them a fine, solid wooden outhouse. Felt very good about it. And he and Grammy went back to the States. 12 years later, in 1920, he went back for a visit. And he found they were using the outhouse for a brooder house. Now, for those of you who don't know, we're not all from an agricultural background, brooding is the term used to describe what hens do when they're sitting on their eggs waiting for the eggs to hatch. A brooder hen is one who's sitting on her eggs. And a brooder house is where the hens are sort of in a safe place to do this. And he was shocked. And they said, but William, we needed a brooder house. We didn't need an outhouse. It's the biggest mistake. It's the one that's made again and again and again. We define their problem by what bugs us. And then we define a solution that makes us feel less bugged, and then we do it to them. And we do it again and again and again. As I said, it's the most common way we work. It's critical to let them, whoever them is, let the people decide what is important. The best advice ever given in this field actually came from a Chinese gentleman. He happened to be a Christian. This is, I think, in the 1920s, James Yen. And he wrote a book on development before development was even recognized as a field. And he began the book saying, go to the people, live with the people, work with the people, start with what they have, build on what they know. And there is no better advice for somebody going into this field today. If I were teaching Peace Corps kids or whoever it might be, that's it. That's where it happens. That's how it works. Don't apply your solutions to their situation. Now, people in developing countries are actually quite accustomed to this. Nobody's better at dealing with this than the Filipinos. You can go in and give them a building, a vehicle, a monstrosity, whatever it was that you thought was just wonderful, and they'll have a party in your honor. They'll have a good time. They'll kill some chickens. They'll be dancing and music. They'll drink Cuba. This is upcountry liquor. Everybody will have a good time. The next morning, they'll be teary-eyed as you leave. And then they'll all sit down and say, what the heck are we going to do with this thing? And they inevitably will come up with something very creative and very useful that addresses their needs. So they never tell you what to do. You come and do whatever you want to. We'll make it work. They're very good at that. 1975, Baramati, Western Maharashtra. This is the part of India, if you land in Bombay and keep going, that's Maharashtra. We were working in well deepening, well digging at the time. The wells get dry in the dry season, just before the monsoons, and they're fairly deep and they're big around. So you give people food because they're desperately hungry, and they work for the food, but they deepen their own wells. And so men would go down with pickaxes, digging at the rock at the bottom of the well, and the women would carry it in baskets, and they'd carry it out of the well and dump it. And what you do is you deepen it when it's dry, so when the rains come, it'll actually hold more water. So we've been visiting these wells and seeing what was happening. I'd come with a colleague from New Delhi, and a couple of guys from the Bombay office were there, and of course our field man who knew the place like the back of his hand. And we're traveling in a Jeep. We'd been doing this Friday and Saturday. We were going to do more on Monday, but you couldn't do it on Sunday. It's a Christian organization. That's fine. So they said, we've got to get from here to here. Let's at least drive on Sunday. We're going to pass through Baramati. There's a little church there, a little village, Padre. We can stop there and have church. And at least part of our group spoke Marathi, the local language. The rest of us didn't. We all said, yeah, that's good. Let's do that. So we got to Baramati. The Padre there is waiting for us and greets us very politely, speaks a little English, which is unusual in that area. I'm the only foreigner. Through most of my career, I was always the only foreigner. I didn't work with large American groups or European groups. It was usually me and my local colleagues. So we go into church. Typically, all the women are sitting on the left. All the men are sitting on the right. There's four or five chairs up at the front where the elders sit behind the pastor. And you can feel the pattern of the church service. You know when they're praying. You know when they're singing. They're reading the Bible, preaching. You feel all this. And I was very comfortable in that setting. I'd been comfortable worshiping with Hindus and Buddhists and Catholics and people in all different cultures. And it was a lovely morning. Fresh breeze was coming through the window. It was not too hot. And I'm just sitting there kind of basking in this. It felt good to be with my colleagues here, guys that I know and work with, and sharing in this service. And I'm kind of in a very pleasant reverie. And it's all in Marathi. I can't understand a word of it. And then I'm shocked. I hear the words in English from the old Anglican prayer book. All ye who earnestly repent of your sins and desire to live in love and fellowship with your neighbor, draw near. I looked up. He was looking right at me. Unsophisticated, uneducated, spoke very little English, no polish. What they call a Padre Babu, not a Padre Saib, a Padre Babu, called me to the Lord's table in my own language. Now, if you have a Christian background, you know that communion is a very important sacred activity for most Christians. And for him to leave his native language, have the entire church wait while he called me and said, you are one with us. You are welcome here. That's powerful. You hear so much that's derogatory, that's put down when we talk about people in developing countries. And it's painful to me because I remember that village pastor. I don't even know his name. We need to honor these people. We need to honor their cultures, their religions. Whether they're Christian, Muslim, or Hindu, who cares? It's their culture. We need to honor them. And we need to have enough humility to acknowledge that because it's different from ours doesn't mean it's less than or not as good as. Because when you approach it with humility, they will reach out to you and honor you and say, we accept you as one of us. Come, come be with us. There's no more powerful experience. 1996, driving from Krasnodar to Stavropol in southern Russia. At the time I was directing a management training institute. This is for managers of Russian nonprofits. We basically taught them everything you need to know to run a nonprofit. How to recruit volunteers, how to work with the board of directors, how to use computers, basic accounting, basic management, what does Russian law say about tax breaks for nonprofits, and so forth. So I'm driving with Nayera, the office manager. Main office is in Krasnodar, and we have a branch office in Stavropol. And we're driving out across farmland. This is much like Kansas. This is that part of Russia. Wheat fields, soybeans. And we're talking about the how agriculture has evolved over the years. And so I was telling him, in Iowa, where I grew up, in the old days, in the 1800s, there were no insurance companies. But what happened is if your barn burned down, which would absolutely destroy you, within a couple of days, all your neighbors started showing up in the buckboards. And they would bring long poles with them. And everybody worked. Typically, the men and boys would build the barn, the women and girls would feed them. Everybody worked. And they would put the poles in the ground, build walls around it, put a roof on it. Even when I was a kid in the 50s, lots of farm buildings were pole barns. And once the roof was on, so that whatever remained to be done, you could take care of yourself, they all simply got in their buckboards and went home. No charge. But later on, if somebody else's barn burnt down, you would get your wagon and take whatever poles you had and your sons and your wife and your daughters, and you go over and spend a week building a barn for them. No charge. Valliere almost had tears in his eyes. He said, Dom, that's what socialism was supposed to be like, but it never worked. He said, in your country, you're not socialists, but you did it. In our country, we were socialists, but we couldn't make it work. It was very painful for him. A few days later, we were back in Krasnodar, and I was talking to Amelia, my assistant who spoke English, telling her this story. She got a funny look on her face. I said, Amelia, what is it? She said, I was just in the kitchen, and Valliere told the very same story. I said, yes. She said, Tom, you speak almost no Russian, and he speaks almost no English. How did you have this complicated philosophical discussion? I said, oh, Amelia, when you speak the language of the heart, everything becomes possible. Sometimes our greatest gift is the ideas and the values that we share. We place a great value, a great importance on the cash we give and the technology we transfer, because we really value those things. But what touches people, what helps them make changes in their own lives, are the values that we share. White House, 1990, press conference. Every year, the president gives out some awards for nonprofits in America, and that year, Heifer won the President's Award for Volunteerism. This is under George Bush Sr. So I got to go to Washington, and they had a nice reception for us, and the next morning, there's a press conference in the old executive office building, and it's a big deal, lights, cameras, and TV people, and the networks, everybody's there. And we were all told, there were four or five of us who'd been given awards of some kind. They all said, keep it down to 2 minutes. Make your thank you very short. So, okay, I had that prepared. I've done this before, right? So I began by saying, well, Heifer International works throughout the world with farmers and their husbands and their families. And the place broke down. I mean, the light people, the camera people, they were just cracking up. Some thought I'd made a mistake. Others got it. And I thought, I'm not missing this opportunity. National TV or not. So I said, well, I didn't mean to digress, but I'm going to. The reality is, for those of you who don't know, Heifer International works with livestock. They give livestock to farmers, and it's quite a process. I said, throughout the world, most livestock is cared for by women and by children under the supervision of women. So if you want to have an effective program, you've got to work with the woman, the wife in most cases. But if you exclusively work with her, number one, her husband will undermine you, and number two, she won't trust it. And so our approach was, we work with the farm family as a productive unit. Husband, wife, children, maybe grandparents, and we address the whole unit. So as we teach them how to care for your animal, what kind of shelter it needs, what do you feed it, how do you grow that kind of feed, how do you butcher the animal or sell the eggs or whatever is called for, officially we're working with the whole family, because that's the only way to get to the woman who's doing 90% of the work. So it is a fact that throughout the world, Heifer International works with farmers and their husbands and their families. And I went on. If you remember nothing else from this morning, remember this. In this field, women are the future. It's already happening. Women are the future. If I had a gazillion dollars and I could start a new NGO today to do whatever I thought was important, we would only work in programs that benefit women and girls, and we would only work through local organizations comprised of, by, and for women. That's where the answers are going to happen. That's where the changes come. I'm not anti-men. But 65 years ago, all the decisions in this field were made by men in this country and by men in wherever else we were working. And we learned over time that that didn't work terribly well. And by the 60s and 70s, we were beginning to have more and more women in leadership in our international organizations, and more women were starting to come into leadership in developing countries. And as women connected with their sisters, things began to happen we never imagined were possible. Here's one painful reality. If a woman earns the money, she's the one who takes care of the hens, gathers the eggs, sells the eggs, if she earns the money, in most cultures, she has a considerable say in how that money gets spent. If the man earns the money, she has very little say. And in most cultures, if she earns the money, a high percentage of that money will be spent on the family. Uniforms so the kids can go to school, food, vegetable garden, a roof, medicine, whatever they need. If the man earns the money, a smaller percentage will go to this. And some of it, this is the way it is, some of it's going to go for gambling and liquor and other outside the home activities. Very unusual if the woman earns the money. And so if you want to make change, socioeconomic change, you need to put money in the hand of the woman, because that's where the change is going to come from. 1989, I was traveling in Mexico for Heifer International. I'll tell you three quick stories from Mexico. In one village, we had said to the people, this is through our field staff, wonderful field staff, this is southern Mexico, near the city of Puebla. Great chap. Said to the people there, there's various animals that Heifer works with. What is best for you? So they got together, and the women in the village decided they'd do pigs. They thought there was a good market for pigs, and they were going to do pigs, and he talked with them. The biggest challenge they faced was feed, because pigs don't just eat table scraps. They also need some special feeds for nutrition and so forth. So their solution was, the women in the village formed a little cooperative of themselves. They all chipped in a little money, have enough money to buy some bags of quality feed that they kept in their little co-op warehouse, a closet, and then they could buy little portions day by day to feed their individual hogs. So that's all the cash flow they had. And it worked very well, and they were very pleased with themselves. And because that was working, they came together and said, what else could we do that would earn a little money for our families? They came up with a great solution. In Mexico, as in many former Spanish countries, First Communion is a big, big deal. The children are 6 years old, they go to the church, they have communion for the first time, they get their picture taken looking up at the priest, and the little girls have beautiful, white, frilly, lovely little dresses, and they have a special candle for First Communion. And oh, it's decorated, it's got bows and lace, a little pearly thing, they're just gorgeous. And the women figured out they can buy the candles, which are cheap, white, short candles, and they could buy the ribbon and so forth, and they could make all these little decorative things that are part of a First Communion candle, and then sell the First Communion candles in Mexico City or Puebla, and make some money that way. And it was a good plan. The day I was there, they actually turned the light on, because they met in a little room, they left the door and the window open, and they didn't use the one electric bulb, but took too much money to do that. But the day I was there, they turned on the lights, for my sake. But otherwise, they worked in the semi-darkness. And as you would expect, they're sitting there several hours a day making their little candles to make a little bit of extra money. And what are they doing? They're talking. And they talk about, among other things, what are some of the problems in our village and what can we do about it? Excuse me. And they began to be troubled by things. They said, that village over there has paved roads. We don't. That village down over there, they have a medical clinic. We don't. This village back up here a few miles, they've got an elementary school. We don't. So they decided to go to the village council and say, what's up? The village council, made entirely of men, of course, said, as you would expect, well, harumph, harumph, harumph. So women decided that to make this change, they would have to change the council. And they decided that they would pick one of them to run for the council, and all the other women would vote for her. This is radical. This is politics. This is taking power. Heifer didn't do it. They did it, which is essential. If we'd tried to do it, it would have failed. And it worked. One of them got on the council. The village was stunned. They'd never had a woman on the council before. And while I was there, they were campaigning for the second woman to get on the council. And one of the women looked me in the eye and cheerfully said, "We will have roads, we will have a clinic, we will have a school, you come back and see." I never made it back, but I bet they do. Heifer went in with pigs, because that's what they chose. And we encouraged them to find a way to make their pig project work, a little co-op, working together. And they took it from there. One thing led to another. And that's the way international development work works. It's the way it's supposed to work. We went down the road to another village where they'd had a project with cows. Give the farmer a pregnant cow, and when she has a calf, then you pass that calf on to another farmer who needs a cow. So we came to a place, little farmstead, and the farmer's very, very proud, and his wife's very shy, off in one corner. And the field man is so good. He says to the farmer, "Wow, your cow's looking really, really good. Oh, yeah, yeah. You must take very good care of it." "Oh, yeah." On and on. And he says, "Does she give a lot of milk?" "Oh, yeah, she gives a lot of milk." He says, "How much milk did she give when you milked her last night?" And the farmer goes over with his wife. Comes back, "Last night she gave so much." "Oh, that's very good. You're doing a great job here. Wow, that much milk. She must eat a lot. Does she eat a lot?" "Oh, she eats such and such and such." "How much did she eat when you fed her this morning?" Talks to the wife. "Oh, this morning she ate such and such." And the wife looked up at me just for a moment, and I just smiled and nodded. I didn't wink, that would be offensive, but I just smiled and nodded, like, "I know what's happening, and it's okay, you're safe, we're not going to blow your cover, everything's all right." Because if she thought this was at risk, the whole thing would break down. The field man did a great job of honoring both of them. They are in a social system where this is what works for them, and you and I might think, "Oh, it'd be better if the social system would change." It's not ours to do, it's their social system, and it will change in due course. In the meantime, they had a cow, they were feeding her, the cow was producing milk, they were getting money from the milk, the family was benefiting, and the arrangement worked for all concerned. Perth, Western Australia, 1976. I'd been invited by the Australian Council of Churches to do a speaking tour. That was cool. We started in the East Coast, went right across the West Coast. One of the really fun experiences in my life. And I was young then, and I wanted to say something that would shock people out of their complacency. I'm still a bit that way. If I were going to reach out to you today, I would say we're all connected. What you do affects people in other countries. And the same was true in 1976. And I said to the Australians, coffee and tea throughout Asia is picked by people who get almost no wages. They're subsistence workers. They live in hovels with mud floors. Most of it's done by young women or even children. And they're paid nothing, and that's reflected in the price you pay for your coffee and your tea. And today, some of you know, we have fair trade programs to try to support coffee growers where the coffee grower gets a decent price. But in 1976, no one had heard of that. And so I said to the Australians, every time you drink tea, you are exploiting subsistence workers. What you do here affects them. We're all connected. It was funny. And there's a famous cartoonist in the newspaper in Perth. And he put this across the top of a big cartoon on the editorial page. Church World Service representative says, every time you drink tea, you're exploiting subsistence workers. Then the cartoon is two Victorian little old ladies, one of them obviously schnockered, and the other one saying, "Yes, but drinking sherry instead is not the answer, Prudence." I still have that cartoon, the original. We can bring a great deal of goodness if we do it with humility and appreciation for the people. There was a time when it was generally felt that they have the problem, we have the answer. In fact, this was said to me by a chairman of Heifer International, and he was from Florida for that matter. He should have known better. It's like teaching a man to fish. There's something good in that. They've got problems. I know what to do. Let me go and help them. You have to respect that kind of caring. But a more accurate way of saying it, I heard from a Mennonite in Bangladesh. By the way, I've worked with lots of Mennonites. If you're ever overseas in a developing country, look for a Mennonite. They're the ones who are doing what matters. Those guys are awesome. They're all over the place. They're just incredible. I don't know what it is about Mennonite philosophy that makes that so, but they are awesome in social action. Talking to a guy in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and he said, we don't have the problems. We don't have the answers. Assuming we know the situation is like a man assuming he knows what it's like to give birth. He can read lots of books and be well educated, but he doesn't know what it's like. He hasn't been there. Worked with dairy co-ops in India. The largest agricultural organization in human history is the network of dairy cooperatives in India. 13 million farmers, 25 million animals, and that was about 20 years ago. I don't know what it is today. Now look at the numbers, 13 million and 25 million, that's less than one animal per farmer, or less than two animals per farmer. That's the average, which means a great number of them is one person with one cow, or maybe a water buffalo. Many of those are widows. A widow with a cow and a dairy co-op has a chance. The way they worked is very interesting, because these people are extremely poor. You'd milk twice a day, right? And you'd come in with your little container of milk to the little co-op center in your village, and while everybody watched, the co-op guy would pour your milk in a container so everybody could see exactly how much it was. It was very open, very transparent. And then he did a quick test to it. I forget what it was, but it's a simple test for fat content. And you got paid based on quantity and quality. And it was all very open. Everybody stood around and watched while it happened. And everybody in the village or everybody in the co-op would stand in line to bring their milk in. And you'd get paid cash on the spot for whatever you delivered. And you'd go around the corner and there's a window where you could buy food for your cow or your water buffalo. And you'd take some of your cash and buy a little food, just enough for one feeding, and go back home. Now we're talking small scale here. There's nothing sophistication. There's no big investment. This is how it worked. And it works extremely well. I did not make that happen. This is done by Indians. It was my honor to work with them. Inevitably, once this got started in the village, the village leaders, the co-op leaders, would come to the co-op organizers and say, oh, we have a problem. Okay. You know, in our village, we have Brahmins, the highest caste, and we have caste Hindus, and we have outcasts, yeah. Typically, there might be a few Muslims, maybe even a Christian. And of course, in our society, these groups don't intermingle. So we can't all stand in one queue, in one line, to bring in our milk. And the organizers go, oh, yeah, that's a big problem, isn't it? What are you going to do about your problem? They say, well, clearly we're going to have different lines. Oh, it's like the Brahmins get served first, and then the other caste Hindus and the outcasts, if we got around to them. Yeah, you know, like normal. Oh, yeah, that would... No, wait. In a co-op, all members are equal. You don't vote your shares, you don't vote your cash. Each person has a vote in a co-op worldwide. So co-op, all members are equal. So you couldn't serve Don DeMaio before you serve this lady over here. It's just whoever got in the queue first. Oh, that is a problem. And they just sympathize with them. And they'd struggle and struggle with this, and they'd work with it. And it kept coming back to, what are you going to do about your problem? But they didn't reject them, they didn't put them down. And village after village would say, well, since it's a co-op, I guess everybody will have to stand in the same queue. Oh, well, if that's what works for you, okay. And as they stood in the same queue, you know what they did? They talked to each other. They'd talk about the rain, they'd talk about their crops, they'd talk about their kids, they'd talk about the government in disparaging tones, I'm sure, but they talked to each other. And they stopped being categories and they started becoming people. And they found that people had different skills and abilities and they could turn to each other. And 5,000, 10,000 years of caste structure began to break down in that village. This has happened in thousands of villages all over India. Now, if you went out and said, I've got a plan to change caste structure in India, you would never get off the ground. But if you said, I've got a plan where very poor farmers, even with just one cow, can handle it productively and successfully and make money and prosper, people say, that's great, let's do it. At one point, the co-op organization went out to the leaders and said, we need your co-op to designate somebody who can come to training for 3 weeks. We're going to give them some training in some technological stuff. It's fairly simple, but it'll enable everybody in the co-op to benefit from it. Just pick somebody who's available to come. Because in most cases, they picked a woman because they weren't working in the fields at that time. It was timed this way on purpose, of course. So they went to the training. Turned out the training was how to become an artificial inseminator. A couple of interesting things happened. After the women did the training, they were very conscientious, of course. Most of them were illiterate by our definition, but not stupid. There's a huge difference. They studied hands-on, they learned how to do it. Very conscientious, very responsible, very high success rate in the artificial insemination. An Indian villager, a man, could deal with it if a man was getting his cow pregnant. He couldn't deal with it if a woman was getting his cow pregnant. Never mind how it happens. It was just conceptually difficult. And so again, they got shook up. Things were changing. It changed the power structure. The woman who was the artificial inseminator had real power, because after people found out that Radha in the next village is really, really good at this, my cow's ready, I call Radha. And she comes, and I appreciate it, and I pay a little fee to the co-op, and they take care of her, and I begin to respect this woman because of what she can do. The really cool thing, though, is halfway through the training, inevitably, one of the women would say, they're getting all the charts and diagrams on the reproductive system of the cow. I mean, they need to know this, right? One of the women inevitably would say, well, if that's true for cows, how does it work in humans? And the instructor would just happen to have some more charts and diagrams about how the reproductive system works in humans. You want to know the two mammals that have the most similar process? It's not dogs and elephants, not cats and giraffes. It's humans and horses, and almost as close as humans and cows. If you know how the reproductive system works in a cow, you pretty much know how it works in a human female. And inevitably, one of the women, as they were learning this, would say, but if you do all of these things to get pregnant, if you do those things, you won't get pregnant. Well, yeah, that's true. We didn't set out to teach birth control. We didn't argue with the fact that every child is a gift from Allah. We didn't set out to upset social mores, but we gave women information and encouragement, and that empowered them. They went back to their villages knowing not only how to be artificial inseminators, but they could talk with the other women in the village and say, you want to not have so many children? I know what to do. I know how it works. That was very powerful. So what have we learned? We've learned that reassurance and encouragement do far more good than corrective action. We're dealing with human beings. We humans respond well to encouragement and reassurance, much better than to being told you're wrong. We've learned to let them lead in choosing what is the problem or opportunity they face and what do they want to do about it. We don't give them our solution to their problem. Working in India in the year 2000, a guy working up in the foothills of the Himalayas. The foothills are 8,000 and 10,000 feet, right? Those are big mountains. And he knew what this village needed, and he wanted to, I'm just going to do so and so and so. They got to find it themselves. Oh, but that's going to take so long, and they're wanting to do this, and they wanted that. They've got to find it themselves, Sunil. You cannot do it to them. Be with them. Care for them. Encourage them. You can make suggestions and back off. Don't give them your answer. Same lesson. This is working with one of our Indian field chaps. What else have we learned? Honor them. Honor their religion, their culture, their traditions, their myths, and have a little humility about it, for heaven's sake. The fact that you're American is interesting, but it doesn't make you right. Share your personal social values. That's where people connect. It's way more important than technology and cash. And yet every report you read in this field will talk about what technology got transferred and how much cash got spent. Invest in women. invest in women by building strong families, because most of the women in developing countries are wives and they're in families and they think of themselves as a family unit, more as we did in this country 100 to 150 years ago. Invest in families in order to strengthen the women, because that's where the future lies. And actually, what is all of this about? It's about one thing. It's all about relationships. How you relate to people is where everything happens, and nothing happens except in a relationship. And I will tell you, this is not about international development. Your ability to create relationships with others begins with your relationship with yourself. And beyond that, your relationship with such ever spirit, deity, power of life that you understand or identify with. And beyond that, your relationships with people who are like you, because most of us are fairly comfortable in a room full of middle-aged, white, middle-income, well-educated, English-speaking Americans with shoes, people like us. We're not as comfortable when none of that is in place. And if you're going to build relationships with people who are not white, not American, don't speak English, not educated, not like you in any way, you've got to have built relationships with yourself and the people who are like you. But if you do that, you will find it's very easy to be your genuine self with people who are totally different, and they will accept you and value you for who you are, not because you're an American or because you are or not a Hindu or a Muslim or an Indian or whatever, but because you're you. They'll value you. And that's where real transformation begins to happen. And I think that's what it's all about. Let me get some water and I'll take a question.